Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Language and Linguistics at La Trobe University. This is episode CLIV, Messalina. Messalina, third wife of Claudius, is likely one of the Roman empresses with the worst reputation. The historians accuse her of adultery and prostitution, avarice and greed, and her name becomes synonymous with a woman of loose morals and licentiousness. But unrelated to these qualities, here's Rhiannon Evans.
Valeria Messalina was the third wife of the Emperor Claudius. Now, he will have four, so she's not going to be the last one. Mm. As you can already tell, this might be a sad story. She's sort of a mysterious figure to us early on, but once she comes into the life of Claudius, we get quite a bit of information about her from, say, the biography of Claudius by Suetonius, and actually much more so from Tacitus and Dio Cassius's histories.
Mm. Ultimately, as many of these Roman empresses are, she's a tangential character to the story of an emperor.
Yeah. As we've seen, even with such prominent female figures as Cleopatra, she doesn't get her own biography. Mm. She turns up in other people's.
Okay. So what do we know about Messalina before she met / married, which probably happened at the same time, Claudius?
So she marries him in around 38, maybe a year later, 39 CE. Mm. All we really know is that she comes from an extremely elite, as you'd expect, family, and is indeed related to the imperial dynasty itself, related to Claudius, a little more distantly than his fourth wife will be. Her father was the consul of 16 BCE, Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus. And if those names seem familiar, it's because that's the family that Nero, the Emperor Nero's father, comes from. Mm. So she is Nero's cousin. And of course, the Julio-Claudian dynasty are therefore related to her. Her most prestigious relative, I'd say, in some ways, is that Augustus's sister, Octavia, is her great-grandmother.
Yes, okay.
On both sides, on her mother's and her father's side.
All right.
It's a very complicated family tree.
I love the Julio-Claudian family tree. It's great.
In some ways, quite incestuous.
So what situation was she in and was Claudius in when they got married? Why was he looking for lucky wife number three? And why was she the good candidate? I guess the pedigree.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she was young, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, he's a member of the imperial family. Remember, at this point, Caligula is emperor, Gaius Caligula, and Claudius is his uncle. Now, everything we are told about Claudius suggests that apart from his lineage, he's not much of a catch. He's seen as a bit of a laughing stock.
He's club-footed, stuttering.
Yeah.
Stammering, sorry.
So... And he's a lot older than her. He's well into his 40s. Mm. So there's, 25-year plus age difference, but that's not too abnormal for elite Roman marriages in particular.
Yes. So she's seen as a good candidate, a good match, and they get married in...
I think they were married in 38 CE, but it may have been the following year.
Okay.
Certainly the following year, she gives birth to their first child. Oh, the following year or the year after that, she gives birth in 39 or 40.
Yeah.
The dates are a little bit fuzzy here until we get into Claudius's reign.
And ultimately, they do have two children.
They do.
This is before he becomes emperor. So she would have married just thinking, I'm marrying a member of the imperial family, not somebody who's going to be incredibly important.
Claudius famously is the most unexpected emperor.
Mm.
I mean, for a start, he's from an older generation to the current emperor, so you're not moving on.
Mm.
And also, as I've said, because of his physical disabilities, nobody thinks of him as prime candidate, but he's in a very dramatic scene in our sources. He's kind of plucked from behind a curtain where he's hiding after the assassination of Caligula. So their first child is Claudia Octavia. In fact, their second child, who will be called Britannicus, named after Claudius's invasion of Britain, so presumably named that after 43 when he invades. But he's born in 41, just a few weeks after Claudius is declared emperor.
Okay.
So in fact, it's just after. And this, of course, means that she has given birth to what looks like the heir.
Yes.
Now, there is no Emperor Britannicus, so you might have guessed Britannicus does not become emperor. That's a whole other history. But it puts her in a very powerful position, of course.
Mm.
Powerful stroke, some would say precarious, because it's a family that's known for sometimes getting rid of potential heirs.
Yes.
So she might have seen some danger there. Claudius has become emperor right at the beginning of 41 CE, 24th of January. And that means Messalina is now the empress.
Claudius needs to move quickly to establish himself as the emperor, or at least to show that he's legitimately the emperor. That would extend as well to Messalina, his wife, as being an Augusta. How does he do that? How does he push her forward?
Well, he doesn't. It's actually the Senate who offers her the title Augusta, right, which will become a normal title for empresses and is something that, say, Livia had. But Claudius says no, he vetoes this. And Dio tells us that. So he does not want his wife to have this title. I think this is certainly something that's fed into Claudius's reputation for not wanting all of kind of fripperies of being an emperor, the extra flattering, and even the idea, which we get largely from Robert Graves and I, Claudius, that he is a republican at heart. I have to say, there's not, apart from maybe something like this, which is very weak evidence, not a great deal of evidence that that's true of Claudius, but it certainly seems to indicate that he is not interested in those flatteries, that he wants to keep things fairly unornamented, fairly plain.
Yeah.
As plain as it can be in that role.
Does it continue that way, though?
Well, in some ways you could say no, that she is actually thrust into quite a prominent role, certainly after he sends an army to Britannia to conquer southern Britain.
Mm.
He holds a triumph, and Messalina is part of that show, this huge display of Roman militarism. So Claudius is at the head of it in his chariot. He is the triumphator, even though he doesn't take an active part in the fighting.
Mm.
And she's behind his chariot in a carriage. Suetonius tells us that. And Suetonius just tells us that in one line, but it's a big thing for a woman to have any part in a triumph.
Mm.
Because, of course, she hasn't participated in the military campaign. And the Julio-Claudian family has been quite good at pushing women forward into public display a bit more from Livia onwards, but it has been much more in a kind of domestic type role as a figure of fertility and a maternal figure. This is a military display.
Yeah.
So she's not naturally a part of that. So that's quite surprising.
Now, we should say, because it'll help us understand the rest of the material that we're going to go into when we talk about Messalina, that she is somebody who has spoken about very hostily with the sources.
Okay, so this is a series on empresses.
Yeah.
You know, stop me when we get to one that the sources treat nicely. Because
there are,
but they are the exception that proves the rule, I think. I mean, some people would say that Tacitus hates women. There are very few women that he approves of. And the thing is, he's talking about the imperial family. So he's talking about women who are prominent and potentially have access to power.
Yeah.
And he doesn't approve of that. So he's not going to approve of any of these women in all likelihood.
Mm.
However, the hostility towards Messalina and the kind of language that's used about her and the way her behavior is described is really, I think, beyond all others. No other woman is treated in such a way.
Mm.
I mean, it still has resonance for us, I think, in the way that women are often sexualized, even if they aren't putting themselves forward as sexual beings, if they're in politics or, I don't know, literary studies. Think of the kind of terminology that's used about them on Twitter and social media.
Mm-hmm.
Messalina's kind of akin to that, the way that she is talked about. She's described as a whore and a hussy and somebody who, you know, had no self-control with her sex life. Most famously, I think the poet Juvenal, we'll talk about him at a little more length, but he's a satirical poet. So
yeah,
it's not like reading a historian. It's a different genre. But he calls her Meretrix Augusta, which means Augusta, the empress, whore.
God.
And it really is that bad a word.
That is brutal.
Yeah.
It's not just historians and a satirical poet going in for a jab, though, as well. You've also got Pliny the Elder. So with such a diverse amount of ancient sources kind of all talking about this, I mean, we're probably bringing this up before we should, but it feels like, you know, is there fire where there's smoke? Anyway, let's go and talk about the content of what we have. Mm. Now, the reason that I bring this up now is because there's a big chunk of Tacitus missing, as in we don't have Caligula when Claudius would have gotten married to Messalina. We don't have the start of Claudius's reign. But when we do start getting Tacitus again, straight away, it's a bad, awful, awful story about Messalina.
So when we rejoin Tacitus in book 11, the very first chapter that we've got starts with the word she, so presumably there's something that comes before it if we had the whole text.
Yeah.
Tells us that she has cooked up a plot to trump up charges in order to get these very famous gardens called the Gardens of Lucullus. For she believed that Valerius Asiaticus, twice a consul, had formerly been her paramour. And as she coveted equally the gardens, which Lucullus had laid down, and Asiaticus was embellishing with conspicuous splendour, she unleashed Suilius to indict the pair. So she gets her favourite lawyer along to make up something about them and get rid of them. Poor old Asiaticus is found at the kind of pleasure resort of Baiae. He's thrown into irons and dragged back to the capital to be put on this charge.
Mm.
So the very first bit of Tacitus we've got in Claudius's reign is hostile to Messalina. So this kind of starts as it goes on.
It also described him as a paramour. So it's saying that she's, you know, fooling around with him as well.
Yeah.
Just a whole raft of charges in the one.
Well, certainly in paragraph. The past she has.
Yeah.
It, I guess, is worse to be adulterous, and she will be described as adulterous while she's married to the emperor.
Mm.
But this is possibly before. However, she's an elite woman, so she shouldn't be sleeping with anyone outside her marriage according to strict Roman moral codes. And Tacitus goes on. The second chapter is about how no one could get to Claudius. All right, this is one of his beefs with empresses.
Mm.
She controls access to the Senate and to Claudius, particularly with this case that I've just talked about with Asiaticus. It doesn't happen in an open court. It doesn't happen with the Senate. It happens in her bedroom. It's like Messalina has done this terrible thing of bringing what should be a public case into the private domain. Mm. And it's her domain. It's where she's in charge. So she's denying him the rights of a Roman citizen.
So shall we talk about Messalina in the private domain then? Because it seems that that's the domain that historians are most preoccupied with when it comes to Messalina, what she's doing in the bedroom.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's, I mean, whether you believe that any of this is happening or not, it's at the very least also code for she is not acting in the way that we want a Roman woman to act, which is to be a lot more in the background. So she's breaking codes and therefore she will be described as sexually promiscuous. I guess the most shocking thing about the tradition on Messalina is that she is described not just as adulterous, but also a woman who sneaks out of the palace at night and goes to a brothel because she wants to act as a prostitute. She wants to be a sex worker.
Mm.
That was very shocking to the Romans. Bad enough from a kind of male standpoint if she is having sex outside of her marriage. Bad for any woman, but terrible if you're the empress. But the fact that she goes to the place of work of these sex workers, who, remember, in Roman society are regarded as the lowest of the low. It's not illegal, but they are infames, which literally means unspeakable. It means they have no legal redress. They can't make a will. They can't get married. All of these legal disabilities that they have, that she wants to associate with them, that she actually wants to do this, means they regard her as just really voracious. She can't contain her sexuality. And she is supposed to engage in a kind of sex contest with a fellow sex worker and the number of men they can satisfy in one night, and she wins with 25.
This is a Pliny story.
Yeah.
That you're referring to. So she challenged a prostitute to a sex marathon, who could last longest, and won with 25 clients. The empress outdid her after continuous intercourse night and day at the 25th embrace, is the exact quote. Pliny 10:172.
Even by the normal standards of Roman senatorial authors, he is more censorious than most.
Yeah.
So he's very shocked at this.
The other one that you were referring to, her going to work in a brothel, is mostly based on a juvenile passage, isn't it? A satirical poem?
It's the one I was talking about before where she's called the Meretrix Augusta, Augustan whore. It's his sixth satire.
Yeah.
It's a long poem for his satire. It's nearly 700 lines long. It's against marriage, but basically it's how bad women are, what they will do to you if you marry them.
A big chunk of that is Messalina, isn't it?
Yeah, Messalina is pretty prominent, and she's kind of an example of how even the House of Caesar, as he calls it, I think, is not cut off from this. So it doesn't matter how high-born you are and how high your status is, women will still bring you down.
Mm.
So that's why that particular story is in there. And shall I just read it? It's quite long.
Is this juvenile?
It's nowhere near the end of the poem, by the way.
Right.
700 lines long, so 117 to 32.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Yeah, by all means, read it out because it's a very emotive kind of language from him.
So Juvenal says, preferring a mat, which is a mat on the floor, presumably, to her bedroom at the palace, she had the nerve to put on a nighttime hood, so she's in a dark cloak, to escape the palace unseen. The whore empress, there's the phrase. Like that, with a blonde wig hiding her black hair, she went inside a brothel, reeking of ancient blankets, to an empty cubicle, her very own. So she has her own place there.
Yeah.
She does this regularly. Then she stood there, naked and for sale, with her nipples gilded under the trade name of she-wolf, which in Latin is lupa, which is also slang for female sex worker.
Mm-hmm. But also a reference, maybe, if you want to go back to Romulus Remus kind of territory.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Putting on display the belly you came from, noble-born Britannicus.
Oh, that's brutal.
Yeah. And it's meant to be. It's she's the one who gave birth to, at that point, seemed to be the future emperor, the heir of the emperor.
Yeah.
And now she's putting her body to this use.
Here you go, Britannicus, read this, your mum's a whore, just in case you had any doubts.
Juvenal's writing in the second century. Luckily, Britannicus is long gone, so
yeah,
he doesn't have to suffer through reading this.
Ah.
He goes on, that is not the end of it. He says she welcomed her customers seductively as they came in and asked for their money. She's extremely wealthy, obviously. Later, when the pimp was already dismissing his girls, she left reluctantly, waiting till the last possible moment to shut her cubicle, still burning with her clitoris inflamed and stiff. She went away, exhausted by the men, but not yet satisfied. And a disgusting creature, with her cheeks filthy, dirty from the smoke of the lamp, she took back to the emperor's couch the stench of the brothel.
I mean, yeah, he doesn't hold back any punches, does he?
No.
There's a lot of shock value in that poem.
Oh, yeah. God, we should talk about Juvenal 6 sometime because I'm not sure this is even the worst part of it. It is very shocking, you're quite right. We should probably put a content warning on this one.
Well, sounds like Juvenal is a whole podcast series to itself.
Oh, my goodness.
Through the satire, so.
Yeah. Like he was, yeah. Anyway, I won't get into it because I won't stop.
Yeah.
it's shocking in the Latin, absolutely. And the language there reflects that, and maybe even a little weaker than the Latin. Everybody is meant to sort of blench at that phrase, Meretrix Augusta.
Mm.
You know, the idea that she is much more willing than all of the other workers in the brothel.
It's
like there's no limit to her abhorrent behavior is the idea.
Yeah. She's not just acting like a whore. I hate using that word, but she's really good at it.
Yeah, indeed. And really keen. Now, it seems so extreme. As I say, it's coming from a satirical poem. Satire doesn't quite mean the same thing for the Romans. It's a genre of poetry, but it's often a genre that deals with stuff that's down and dirty and extremes. So, you know, it's about sex and food, and it often describes people in extreme ways.
Mm.
Now, it's not like there are no problems with biographies and histories and the kind of sources we've got, but satire is a whole other genre, and it often means to shock. Juvenal often means to shock.
Is this the Roman equivalent of a dirty limerick?
Oh, kind of. I mean, no offense to limericks, but it's a little more sophisticated, I guess. I mean, he's written the same meter as epic poetry.
Yeah.
So, and you know, Juvenal is a fantastic poet.
Mm.
It's fun to read, but it's horrible to read at the same time.
Mm.
I don't think the Romans would have taken satire at face value either. They'd have not seen this as having truth value. All right. It's potentially fake news.
But when you've got her acting like that in an account from Juvenal, and you've got Pliny saying the same sort of thing, and then you've got Tacitus and the other historians kind of weighing in, this gets back to the where there's smoke, there's fire kind of thing that I said earlier.
So difficult when you're talking about women in particular
yeah.
who don't have their own account. If I had to make a stand on this, I'd say that the historical accounts of Messalina's downfall, sorry, there will be a downfall, involve the story that she has an affair and that she intends to somehow make her lover emperor. And the fact that there is adultery and an attempt to overthrow the emperor coming together could be the start of depicting her as an adulteress of sexually voracious.
Okay.
We'll talk about the details of that story, but it's possible that that kind of spins out into these stories of going off to the brothel.
All right. Well, let's put a pin in that then. And let's talk about how awful she was in other ways.
Yeah, she's not only depicted as somebody who's not faithful within her marriage, she is depicted as an incredibly mean person.
It's just like, okay, where do we start? So was she one of those empresses, or do the historians tell us that she was one of those empresses who is always on the lookout for who could be a credible threat?
She is certainly depicted like that. So, you know, the Julio-Claudian family is quite big. And there've been adoptions along the way, without wanting to get into that very complicated family tree. The very beginning of it is Augustus adopting his stepson Tiberius. So anyone that can claim direct descent back to Augustus.
Or even Tiberius at that point.
Yeah. And Germanicus. You know, Germanicus was Tiberius's nephew.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes back to Livia's other son. They might be potentially a threat.
Drusus.
Yes.
Sorry.
Well done. Yeah.
You always sound surprised.
I'm just pleased. It's not surprised. Oh my God. Sorry. I don't mean to sound patronizing, but I probably can't help it.
No, that's okay. I'll take the well done's when I can get them.
It's a complicated thing, the imperial family, and I think you could argue that in later times it becomes less and less important to have this blood link because we get so many adopted emperors. But at this point, there is still this strong memory of Augustus, and any links to him and maybe some direct descendants of Livia could potentially have a better claim on the imperial throne, as it were, the imperial purple.
Where there is ever a link, you are going to get a threat, I think. Even when you get later on down the dynasties. I mean, it's a big part of the Severan dynasty. Most of the Severans are only related to Septimius Severus through the marriage of his wife. If Messalina's worried about it now, she's probably got good reason, maybe.
Yeah, so, you know, you have events like Agrippina the Younger, Agrippina Minor, who, spoiler, will be Claudius's fourth wife.
Mm-hmm.
And Julia Livilla, who have both been exiled, right? They've both annoyed Caligula. They get recalled, but Julia is soon exiled again on a charge, ironically enough, of adultery. Now, this is very, very common in the imperial family. It's probably a false charge in this case, maybe a false charge in other cases too. In this case, it's charge of adultery with Seneca the Younger. I don't think many people believe that. And it's common if you want to get rid of a woman in particular from the imperial family. There's a history of this having happened from the very moment that Augustus made it illegal. You know, he's had to banish members, his daughter and his granddaughter.
Yeah.
So this is the way that you get rid of women from the court.
Mm.
So, you know, Claudius is the emperor. Technically, he's the one who carries out this banishment, this exile. But our sources are always suspicious of Messalina being the power behind the throne, and that it's her jealousy, it's her feelings of threat that means that this has been kind of the nail in the coffin for whoever is got rid of. She's also described as being corrupt by some sources. So Dio Cassius claims that she is selling all kinds of things like Roman citizenship to foreigners.
Mm.
So in Book 60, Chapter 17, he says, Messalina and her freedmen kept offering for sale and peddling out citizenship and military commands, procuratorships and governorships. So it's as if she, and of course people like Dio are very suspicious of ex-slaves too, having power in the imperial court, and she's kind of on a par with them, that they shouldn't have anything to do with this. They shouldn't be involved in this high-powered administration. But somehow she's involved in doling these things out. And again, she's making money from it. So a bit like those rumors of her enjoying going off to the brothel and taking the money, Juvenal's version, she's associated with getting money from illicit sources.
Right.
I think this is meant to sound sort of mean. Why would she need to do that? She's in this incredibly privileged position, but yet she wants more. So she's greedy. She's avaricious. She's also depicted as being very petty. Mm. So sexually voracious, as we've mentioned, adulterous. But if she's turned down by a man, then she will get back at them, wanting to take revenge. So, for example, Cassius Dio says the two men, Marcus Vinicius, Julia Lavilla's husband, and Appius Silanus, who's her own stepfather, so married to her mother, she is rejected by both of them. And then she accuses them of adultery to get rid of them.
Okay.
Ironically, that's what will eventually be her undoing, accusations of adultery. But in the meantime, she's using that to get rid of anybody she regards as a threat, or, as Dio represents it, just simply not having done what she wants.
Yeah. So she's greedy, she's avaricious, she's spiteful against her family members, but I guess ultimately she's just really adulterous, I think is the main kind of thing that she'd have on her tombstone if Tacitus has anything to do with it.
Yeah. And it's partly because this is what ends her, as it were. Mm. This is what brings about the end of her time as empress and the end of her life.
None of this can reflect well on Claudius. He feels really gullible that all of this is going on behind his back.
That's the way he's depicted. He's depicted as, I love this word, uxorious, which means he's kind of under the thumb of his wives, all right?
Yeah.
Utterly in their thrall. The word uxor is Latin for wife. So it's not just Messalina. He's depicted as being somebody who's subservient to both wives and freedmen.
Mm.
Those are equally bad things from the male Roman point of view. Messalina makes use of this. His next wife will certainly make use of it too. And it's like he's too enamored of them. You know, he finds out about Messalina's adulteries and he doesn't mind. It's only when he thinks she's actually trying to get rid of him that his ardor cools, as I think Tacitus says. So this kind of source that tells us that freedmen and Messalina have him under their thumb is compounded by the fact that Messalina is seen as acting in conjunction with freedmen. So she's kind of getting together with some of the imperial freedmen and names like Narcissus and Pallas and Callistus, who are all important members of Claudius's court. All right. So freedmen often during this period would have what we think of as kind of high-powered PA type roles, right? Yeah, they're his assistants, secretaries, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
In charge of finances, in charge of his correspondence, which is a really powerful role. And she is kind of ganging up with them to deceive, to play against Claudius. She's involved in power play to control him.
Mm.
So not initially to oust him, but just to direct what's actually going on. That's very much the way that Tacitus, Suetonius, Dio depict the imperial court at this point. And she's kind of the evil center of this, directing activities. For example, Suetonius, in chapter 29 of the life of Claudius, tells us this very explicitly. He says, wholly under the control of freedmen and his wives, that is Claudius, as I've said, he played the part not of a prince, but of a servant, lavishing honors, the command of armies, pardons or punishments, according to the interests of each of them, or even their wish or whim. In other words, it was his wives and freedmen. Their interests were important. Mm-hmm. They just asked him to do something and he did it.
I.e., I would like that man's garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or I would like that man dead.
Yeah.
Or both. However, Suetonius says he doesn't really believe something about Claudius. He doesn't believe it was quite this bad. And this is in relation to Messalina and the final rumors about her last affair.
Mm.
But it is beyond all belief that at the marriage which Messalina had contracted with her paramour, her lover, Silius, he signed the contract for the dowry with his own hand.
Mm.
So Messalina is accused of being married to the emperor and marrying someone else at the same time without having got divorced. Remember, divorce, not difficult for Roman society, although maybe a little bit.
When you're talking about the emperor.
Yeah, he's probably the one who will enact that. But Messalina commits bigamy. this is fairly consistent in the sources, with this man who is called Silius. And there is one rumor clearly going around that Claudius was so complicit, so enamored of her, would do anything for her, that he even signed the contract, that he allowed this to happen, gave it his blessing.
He mustn't have known what was put in front of him.
Suetonius says that he doesn't think it happened at all. All right. So it's not like there's evidence that this contract for the dowry exists. I think that even Suetonius, who will report some really outrageous stuff, thinks this is this is beyond the pale. Claudius was not that stupid.
You know it's outrageous when Suetonius won't go near it.
and even the rumor itself is quite interesting. Suetonius says, well, people explain this away by saying that he was induced to do so, I'm quoting again the same passage, on the ground that the marriage was a feigned one, designed to avert and turn upon another a danger which was inferred from certain portents to threaten the emperor himself. All right, so this rumor is so outrageous that even the story to support it is presumably that the person married to Messalina will come to grief. It's not very clear, but I'm assuming that's what it is. And so to turn away these portents, he has her fake marry someone else, like the portents wouldn't know.
Right.
Yeah, so it's kind of a fake story within a fake story that Suetonius doesn't believe. However, he's not saying that it's fake that she did marry him. He's just saying it's fake that Claudius was involved in that marriage.
Yes, so the fact is that it actually did happen. She went and married Silius while being married to Claudius.
Our sources are pretty consistent on it.
Yeah.
That there was an affair and that she actually conducted a marriage with him.
Okay, this is essentially the downfall of Messalina. So let's wade into that. So Claudius is off at Ostia inspecting his new port.
Yes, there's something important he does. He builds a new harbour there.
Mm.
And Claudius doesn't know about Messalina's affair with Gaius Silius. While he's away, Messalina marries Silius. And she also, although she doesn't have the power to do this, makes him consul and starts giving him lots of the emperor's property. In furnishing a house for him with furniture from the palace.
Yeah.
It's that outrageous in our sources.
Okay.
Now, Narcissus, who had been part of her little circle of imperial freedmen.
Yeah. Collaborators.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good word. He realizes, we're told in Suetonius, I think it is, well, this is not going to look good for me when the emperor finds out. I mean, fairly obvious. And I have to say, my trouble with this story is, did they really think they were going to get away with this? Were they intending to kill Claudius?
Yeah, it's massively dubious. There is no way that you can get away with this. The emperor is going to come back and go, hey, where's my statues to start with?
And where's my wife?
Well, it sounds like he didn't have quite a good hand on that anyway. But, and who's that sitting in the consul chair?
Yeah, indeed. We do have consistency within the few sources we have here. But I don't think they explain it very well. Suetonius doesn't go into an awful lot of detail, and they don't really get to grips with what the intention of the usurpers was, and the bigamist empress. So, yeah, I'm slightly suspicious. However, the psychology of Narcissus is explained as he realized that this would be something that the emperor would not look kindly on, so he decided to be the turncoat who went and told Claudius what was happening.
Well, he tells somebody to tell Claudius.
Yeah. So Narcissus has a message sent to Claudius.
Yeah.
To expose the plan, such as it is.
All right. So the plan. So how does Claudius react then?
Well, Dio tells us that the message he's given is specifically phrased to scare him and give him the idea that Messalina is going to kill him and set up Silius as ruler. So he's persuaded, and he has to be persuaded even at this stage, to arrest and torture a number of people who are involved in this plot, presumably. And then he goes back to the city immediately upon his arrival. He puts to death some of those involved in it, Mnista with many others, and then slew Messalina herself after she had retreated into the gardens of Asiaticus, the gardens of Lucullus that she had craved, which more than anything else were the cause of her ruin, says Dio. So that's Dio, book 61, chapter 31.
Nice callback, Dio, to the gardens being nicked. So that is a very brief account, considering what we get from the other historians, isn't it, who seem to very much kind of relish in the downfall of Messalina.
Yeah, it's more in Tacitus. We don't get a whole lot in Suetonius. Of course, he's describing the life of Claudius, not of Messalina.
Yeah.
But Tacitus does revel in it. I do like this quote at Book 11. This is the Annals, Book 11, Chapter 26. By now the ease of adultery had cloyed on Messalina, and she was drifting towards untried debaucheries. This is the kind of thing that makes you really sad that the reign of Caligula doesn't remain from Tacitus. Imagine how he would have described Caligula.
Yeah, maybe that was a book by itself. The Annals, the Histories, and Caligula.
Yeah, I think he would have enjoyed describing those. But this idea that we don't use this phrase anymore, but clearly it means she's just bored with adultery. It's not enough. Mm. It's not dangerous enough. She's depicted just like a risk taker. She's a daredevil.
That kind of would go some way to describe the whole I'm getting married while I'm still married scenario.
Yeah.
Let's see how far I can push this.
Yeah. And Silius, if we want to get into him, is described by Tacitus as blinded by his fate or convinced perhaps that the antidote to impending danger was actual danger. So there's a real psychology going on there. Mm. And I know this is Silius, not Messalina, and we're primarily talking about Messalina, but I think it is a highly rhetorical sentence. Notice he gives us that alternative. Is it just he can't see what's going to happen? Or maybe he's so addicted to danger that he thinks, let's make it more dangerous. Let's not keep secret anymore, in other words. So began to press for the mask to be dropped. Let's be all out in the open that we're having this affair and we're plotting against the emperor. Let's not wait for him to die. His old age is not to be defended on, and let's go for it. I guess here you could say that Silius is seen as the main proponent of this plot because he's the one who's propelling it forward. And he's telling her Messalina would retain her power unaltered with the addition of a mind at ease. He would adopt Britannicus because he has no children. And they just need to get rid of Claudius. And Messalina here is described by Tacitus as being very calm and collected. All right, so she took his phrases with a coolness due not to any tenderness for her husband, but to a misgiving that Silius, with no heights left to scale, must spurn his paramour and come to appreciate at its just value a crime sanctioned in the hour of danger. Again, complicated psychology going on. Messalina seems to think that if Silius gets what he wants, maybe there'll be no risk-taking left. He won't be excited anymore. Tacitus also describes how she can see it might go wrong, but she wants what he calls the name of wife. Right? She coveted the last delight of the profligate. She wants this bigamous marriage. It doesn't seem like it's security, though. She can see there might be dangers here, but she wants this to happen anyway. So I guess he's describing her as someone who's tripped up by her desires. That, in fact, it's Silius who's completely reckless and she's now maybe enthralled to him. I mean, he has a good line in persuading her, in telling her that basically Britannicus will be his heir and she'll still be powerful. Presumably that's what she wants to hear as well.
Okay.
She wants this marriage and it makes no sense, of course, because it's illegal. It's meaningless because she's not divorced. It doesn't really matter. And I guess it would have mattered if she hadn't died shortly afterwards, but they don't kind of have to face the legal case because she's not going to survive very long.
So the marriage, if we can call it that, clearly doesn't last very long. And Claudius gets word through his freedman Narcissus that this has gone down and decides to go back to Rome from Ostia. We're told that Messalina's having a party. There seems to be grape squishing going on and winemaking and much revelry. A man climbs up a tree and is asked, you know, what do you see in the distance? And he replies with the line, a frightful storm over Ostia. He sees a very angry Claudius coming back, who is kind of vengeful of the whole situation and wants to know where all his nice clothes have gone and everything like that.
Furniture.
Yes. Didn't say the extent of his belongings, did they? I don't know. His favorite toga. The main account that we get from this is from Tacitus. So what does Tacitus tell us about the death of Messalina?
All right, so when she hears Claudius is coming back, she hides in those much-coveted gardens of Lucullus. She's stolen from Asiaticus. She's fighting for life, he says, but she still thinks she might be able to get around Claudius. She's composing a petition, so a begging letter. She hopes that she might get away with it. So Claudius comes back, grows a little heated with the wine, says Tacitus, and tells somebody to go and inform, as he calls her, the poor woman, that she must be in his presence the next day to plead her cause.
Mm.
And in fact, at this point, if you didn't know already, which Tacitus's readers would have done, they might think there was some hope for Messalina, because Tacitus says his anger was beginning to cool, his love to return. And of course, Claudius has this reputation for giving way to his wives. And those that have kind of given Messalina away and now afraid that he will be won over by Messalina and then they'll be in trouble.
Mm.
So you can see this kind of anxiety and power play going on within the palace. So Narcissus realizes that he's got to get Messalina there while Claudius is still a little bit angry. And he basically burst out of the room, ordered the centurions in attendance to carry out the execution.
So don't even bring it back.
No.
Yeah.
And he says, it's the emperor who said this. Mm. This is the kind of episode where you can see that if this is true, this is why the Senate was annoyed that freedmen had so much power in the imperial court, because Narcissus is giving this instruction. It does not come from Claudius.
Mm.
One of the freedmen hurries to the gardens of Lucullus, where she is hiding out. Messalina is, she's lying on the ground, prone on the ground, and her mother, Lepida, is also there. Tacitus tells us at this point had not been close to her daughter, but now is there out of pity to kind of minister to her. And she's telling her, well, don't wait for it to happen to you. Take it into your own hands, which is the death sentence of the elite. It's suicide for the Romans.
Mm.
She says to her, life is over and done. All that can be attempted is decency and death. Which is a very kind of Roman, valorous way to go out.
Yes.
But Tacitus enjoys this because, of course, if she'd done that, if she had killed herself, then there would have been a little, as her mother says, honor in her death. But honor had no place in that lust-corrupted soul, says Tacitus.
Tacitus.
I know. You see, this is something to match Juvenal here, isn't it? And tears and lamentations were being prolonged in vain. So she's got no honor. She's not going to do this. I was quoting there from Tacitus, Book 11, Chapter 37. And at that point, those who've been sent by Narcissus rush in. They start insulting her, shouting at her. And for the first time, she sees the reality here. She saw her situation as it was. This makes her braver in her agitation. So she takes hold of the steel, says Tacitus, which in other words is she gets the sword or the dagger.
Mm.
But she can't do it. This is a bit like later on Nero.
Nero
can't kill himself.
Yeah.
All right. So she's applying it without result to her throat. But the tribune comes in and runs her through. So they finish her off.
Mm.
So it's an incomplete suicide. And then she doesn't get the choice. The body is given to her mother. And the message is taken to Claudius that Messalina has perished, which is a very neutral way of describing a murder.
Yeah, but I think that also, spare the emperor of the details that he doesn't need to know. At that point, if you're thinking about the perspective of the freedman who orchestrated this little episode.
Tacitus specifically says that they're not specific.
Mm.
They don't say she killed herself or someone killed her, just she has died.
Yes. And Claudius doesn't seem to be too fussed.
He doesn't ask at that point. Look, he clearly is upset, though, because Suetonius tells us that afterwards he talks as if she's still there. Well, I read that as him being upset.
Yeah.
He kind of forgets that she's dead. I think Suetonius actually means it to make us think that Claudius has some kind of dementia, has had some kind of breakdown. But I think you could also read it as a sort of shock and disbelief.
In this moment, he betrayed no symptoms of hatred or of joy, of anger or of sadness, or in fine, of any human emotion. Not when he saw the accusers rejoicing, not when he saw his children mourning. His forgetfulness was assisted by the Senate, which decreed that the name and statues of the emperor should be removed from private and public places.
Which is damnatio memoriae.
Yes.
All right, so that sentence could make you think, oh, they're just trying not to remind Claudius. But there's an inscription that proves that it was damnatio.
A scrubbed out one that we've got somewhere.
This is wiping out of her memory, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, other sources, Seneca, remember Seneca, who was supposed to have had an affair with Julia Livilla, it was.
So essentially got banished by Messalina.
Yeah. Yeah,
nice friendly source.
Seneca, he's brought back to be the tutor of Nero and continues to be Nero's advisor after Claudius dies and writes a work called the Apocolicantosis.
Pumpkinification.
He kind of reads it as Claudius is indifferent to Messalina's death. Again, though, it's prose, but it's a satirical piece, so probably should be taken with a pinch of salt.
Okay, so given that 90% might be a bit too low, but, you know, 93% of what we have written about Messalina is hostile. Yeah? Is there anything nice said about her? Was she a good mother? Okay. You know you need to speak in a podcast because they can't see.
Yeah, but the silence is telling, don't you think? I think it's pretty much 100% hostility.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything that was nice. So given all of that and the fact that we've got three historians, a limerick writer, and Pliny the Elder bagging out Messalina, how much of that should we believe?
I would say the juvenile, I would not put any credence into. So the whole, you know, she's at the brothel, staying there all night.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't either.
The competition with the sex worker.
From Pliny, yeah.
No.
No? Okay.
Look, I mean, I'm a great fence sitter, so saying no is pretty meaningful, I suppose. But yeah, they seem too extreme. They just seem really extreme. You'd have to believe that Claudius, who would mind that the dignity of his office and his role and his status is being impugned here, for him to have this hidden from him and not believe it even when he's told that she's committing adultery, I just think all of that's very extreme.
What about the broad strokes, the Silius, the she wanting the gardens, banishing her mother's husband because refusing advances, all of that kind of stuff, conspiring with the freedmen?
You think it's too much evidence, don't you? Or too many tellings of this to...
Well, the fact that we've got evidence of a damnatio memoriae.
Memoriae.
That. Would seem to indicate... I'm losing all my points I got from Drusus. Would seem to indicate, you know, that something went down, that she did something worthy of that.
Yeah, but then I guess you could say that if there's power play going on in the palace... Mm. And she loses out to the strategy of one of the freedmen.
Mm.
If Claudius is under their spell, then they direct what happens next, which is that she must be persona non grata. She must be wiped out.
Mm.
It could go either way. I don't think it's impossible that she was an adulteress. You know, adultery happened in Roman antiquity. It happens in every society, I suspect.
Yeah.
It's just that it was illegal for women in particular in ancient Rome. And if you're the empress, then it can be read as an act of treason.
Mm.
However, even Tacitus, who is no defender of basically any woman, says that she was not kind of given her day in court. I mean, from Tacitus's point of view, that is an illegal killing. If she had killed herself, that's one thing.
Mm.
But this is coming at the behest of a freedman. Claudius, he's not even in charge of that. She should have been brought back and asked to answer his questions. So Tacitus doesn't approve of this process either.
Mm.
There is a whole lot of machination going on there, and that's why it's so hard to get at the heart of it.
Yeah,
I would say that another way of reading Messalina, and I think quite a persuasive one, is in the framework of what is going on within that dynasty. All dynasties are complicated, but we've used the word power play a lot. And there are these conflicts within the imperial court. We said at the outset that she might well see threats to her place within it and Britannicus's place within it. So some of these actions can be understood as attempts to secure her position, which, you know, is not to say that it's okay to have people executed on no charge. But she may have done some of these things out of desperation. She had a certain amount of power and she used it to try and ensure that she was safe and that Britannicus would be the next emperor. And you could see her marriage to Silius as serving the same kind of end. She just read it very badly. She read what was going on very badly. If all of the freedmen had stayed loyal to her, then would it have been a completely different outcome? Would the dynasty actually have turned on Messalina and Britannicus? And actually, given what did happen historically, that next Claudius will marry his niece Agrippina the Younger, and Britannicus will be ousted by Nero.
Yeah.
Messalina was kind of right, wasn't she?
That could have been a very different story, yeah. Right, so at the time of her death, she's been married to Claudius for about 10 years.
So her children are about, they're under 10. Obviously, Britannicus is born around the time of Claudius coming to power, so around 41. So Messalina dies in 48. Her son's only about 7. He's lost his mom.
So that leaves, you know, Claudius ripe for the next wife who's going to...
Well, if you believe our sources, absolutely, that he will be led by his wife. He will be led by his kind of complete devotion to his wife.
I would like to talk to you now about how we think about Messalina in the modern context, because there's two kind of things. One is that she's almost become a catch cry for an adulterous woman. Like, she's like the pinnacle example that people go to, and also of, you know, an impressively skilled prostitute, I guess, or a seductress, or those kind of things can be referred to as a kind of Messalina type character. Anytime somebody is called a Messalina type character, it is never a compliment.
Absolutely not.
No. Unless they're being complimented on any. Anyway, so say more academic things about what I just said.
She was at one point quite popular in Western art, so in painting, and particularly in French literature and painting and operas. And in all of that, she is this token of an over-sexualized elite woman who kind of then falls into the gutter through these practices. So they're taking Juvenal and running with it because it's outrageous. So a lot of this French literature and art likes that contrast, I guess, of the sexual adventures. And being British, I say, oh, of course, the French.
Well, you can't let them have free rein there, because that, I guess, in turn influences what Robert Graves writes, and then you get I, Claudius.
So in Robert Graves' novel and in the BBC production of the novels from the 1970s, yeah, she's very much depicted in that way. And we do get the competition in the brothel. We get the attempt to overthrow Claudius. And I think that has kind of sealed her reputation, because it's the first version of her I ever saw. Before I'd read Tacitus and Suetonius, and I wasn't, I'm afraid, aware of these French paintings and operas. So I guess that was my introduction to Messalina. And of course, we do have to remember that Robert Graves is trying to do, and he's writing a novel, so it's fictional, but he's also trying to overturn the ancient version of Claudius. He's only really interested in Claudius. Claudius is his main concern. Claudius was seen as this idiot by those ancient works. He sees Claudius as this very upright moral character who's much more intelligent than people give him credit for, and he's a survivor. He survives the imperial family because they think he's a fool. And then he's kind of taken advantage of. Graves does play along with that aspect of it. He's taken advantage of by his wives. With Agrippina, he tries to strategize and he fails. With Messalina, he is taken in. He doesn't realize in the novel and the TV version that she is unfaithful, and he's dreadfully upset when he finds it out. So because that series is seen through him, he's our way into this history and that imperial family. There's no way, really, if you're going to go along with any of Messalina's story, of making her anything but a really devious, deviant, unsympathetic character. When she's first introduced, she's so young.
She was very innocent at the start. Vulnerable. Yeah,
she's turned, isn't she, by the power, by the men around her.
She essentially comes into Claudius's life, smooth talks him, and then as soon as he leaves the room, she essentially goes, ah, ha, 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 and there we go.
So she's two-faced.
Yeah, definitely. You know, straight away, it's like Claudius just laps it up. You know, she calls him handsome. She says everything that she's meant to. And straight away, you can just see that she's using him for a power play kind of thing. And you do get, like, all those big scenes of her being annoyed with her mother's husband because he refuses her advances. Her challenging the prostitute to the competition is a big scene in this show, and just kind of really shocking at how much it shows you slash doesn't show you.
Mm.
And, you know, the whole episode with Silius is kind of all played out there. And it's hard not to therefore go back to Tacitus and read the accounts of all of these sort of things and not see it through Robert Graves's lens, if I can put it that way.
Yeah. That's a problem with watching I, Claudius. It's so persuasive, and you've been watching it recently, so you're much more familiar with it at the moment.
I have
seen it for a while.
So that was Sheila White, her name was, playing the role of Messalina. It is very iconic, and it is kind of very persuasive as to how people now think of Messalina, I think.
Tacitus does describe Gaius Silius as the handsomest man in Rome. So if you think about the fact that Messalina is, I know this was more normal in Roman society, but she's married to this really quite elderly man who is at least 20 years older than her, who's very bookish, all right?
Nothing wrong with bookish?
I don't think so, but, you know, for a young flamboyant girl, probably not much fun. And then, you know, it's not marriage is not necessarily meant to be much fun in Roman terms, especially if you're an elite person. This is a kind of a dynastic marriage. But I like that quote that he's the handsomest man in Rome, because I think it does help us to excuse Messalina a little. She's young. Let her have some fun.
That's Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans, head of the Department of Language and Linguistics at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic. And thanks for listening.